Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories.
Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chuck.
And we have got a special episode this week. I think it's a special episode because it was John's dad's turn in the bucket, I think, early on. The first three episodes of the show were me, John, and his dad. And then we brought my father on. My father, as our longtime listeners will know, is a retired LAPD from the days of the Wild Wild West at LAPD, which was like 1970 to 1995. And this week, Chuck, I'm going to turn it over to you because you have brought us your father to bring us full circle.
Yeah, so bringing on my dad, he was a cop in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Did about 32 years, two different agencies. And this was back in the days that when you got hired onto the police department and you started working a beat on the street, you didn't go to the academy first. You did on-the-job training, waited 6 months, and then went to the academy.
Right.
You know, this is back in the heydays of policing. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Oh, it went completely black.
No, I know. I just had to stop my video for a second.
Got it. This was in the days of just, you know, bare bones police work. I mean, I don't even know if he had a radio in the car. He was probably still on a horse and buggy. I mean, he is old as dirt. And I'm only saying that because he's right next to me and I like to give him a hard time.
Can't wait because I have a front row seat when he decides to whoop your ass.
But he can't, he's too old.
Yeah, you know what? Welcome, sir. Why don't you introduce your dad to the audience?
This is my dad, Robert. Due to confidentiality reasons, his last name will stay a secret.
Yeah.
He did 32 years. I always mess it up. I said 33 a bunch of times. I guess it was 32. I got corrected. State police and then the California Highway Patrol.
Well, welcome to the show, Robert. From me personally, I'd like to thank you for all your years of service, but also for spawning Chuck, who has been a great co-host since taking over at the beginning of the year.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're excited. Chuck said you were coming to visit and was a total no-brainer. We had to get you on the show. He's quoted you and he's talked about you many times, so I'm sure our audience will really enjoy getting to hear firsthand how much of a shithead your son really was growing up. I mean, all your
I'm sure we could spend like 2 hours, 3 hours, maybe the rest of the day just talking about that.
Yeah. We could. But for what he didn't listen to me when he was a kid, I got even. I sent him to the Marine Corps.
Right.
It's the same guy that said he would disown me if I went to any other, well, to the Army. He actually kicked the Army recruiter out of the house. And I really wanted to join the Army.
Go with John?
Well, that was before John decided that he was going to go into the Army. I had been trying to go into the military for I guess the beginning of my senior year, maybe even my junior year, I knew I wanted to go to the military for a very long time. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to try the Army. And he said, no.
I gave him three choices. Army or not the Army. I gave him three choices, Marine Corps, Navy, or Coast Guard. He ended up in the Marine Corps.
Well, there you go. Those, if those are your three choices, you made the right decision, I think.
Well, I originally tried the Navy, kind of got turned down. So I was like, well, I'll go to the Marine Corps. they just didn't want to give me the job I wanted and tried to shove me in something else that I didn't want to do. So I was like, yeah, I'll go to the Marine Corps.
Yeah,
and they did the same thing.
I had a friend that learned that lesson.
I just figured since he wouldn't listen to me, he'd damn sure listen to a Marine Corps DI. And I was right.
Yeah, right. Squared him away.
I was right.
So
but now, he's done well since he got out.
Yeah. As soon as he got out, right?
Yep. Well, as soon, yes.
So, Robert, why don't you tell us, sir, a little bit about your background and kind of how you ended up putting on the badge and the uniform?
Well, I was I went to high school and went to the tried to go into the military after that, but due to some physical limitations, at the temporary physical limitations, I was prevented from going into the Marine or into the military. So I went to college and did 2 years in college studying criminal justice and got out. And in the 70s, when you got out, there was Vietnam was almost completely done. And there was a lot of people coming out of the military that were joining law enforcement all across the nation. And they had a lot of different federal programs that employed the military guys as they were coming out. And I was really finding it difficult to get hired. So I got a call from home probably about, about 5-6 months after I got out of college, got a call from home and my parents were telling me, hey, there's an opening out here for the California State Police. And I had no idea what the California State Police was. And
okay.
I didn't know that when I talked to the state police sergeant out there at the detachment in the town that I came from, that when I got hired, that I would have to be answering that question, what is the California State Police, almost 4 or 5 times a day. It got kind of old after a while, but
that's an old board question right there. Hello, sit down. How are you? What is the California State Police?
Believe it or not, I used to ask that question when I sat on oral boards to hire people into the California State Police. I'd ask them, tell me about the California State Police. What do you know? And you'd be surprised at the answers that I got. And I was surprised at the answers that I got, and they promptly failed. But I did get hired with the California State Police as a temporary person, 9-month appointment, zero training.
Wow. Really?
And, yes. And my first,
I'm talking you back in the day, dude, they just,
it was 1974.
Oh, no. Yeah. My dad April had a 1st. Call box key.
Oh shit.
Well, it was April 1st, 1974. And, our station was, in the town that I was hired in was, borrowed. And, we had 2 patrol cars, 4 officers, 1 sergeant, but the officers were not police officers. They were state security officers with the California State Police. So that was my first job.
So is that one of those like 832 or you're a peace officer only while on duty kind of a thing?
Yes, it was 832 schooling. It was under 830.4 of the penal code.
Okay. And so for the audience, real quickly, it's a little inside baseball. We're talking about the California Penal Code sections that declare who and what a police officer or a peace officer, I should say, is. And so there are different variations on how somebody can be classified as a police officer. So that's all we're talking about. We just had a moment.
Yeah. So anyway, I started that. I was put into the field by myself after a week's worth of training with 2 other officers. And one of the officers that helped train me was junior to me in high school. He graduated a year behind me. And, mm-hmm. And the other one was quite senior to me, but after a week's worth of training, I was put into a police car and sent out into the field to patrol a California aqueduct, which was my beat. Was 110 miles long and about half a mile wide.
What? Wow. So that was really just your job was infrastructure.
Well, we were to patrol the California aqueduct and all of the properties that the aqueduct was part of. And so that encompassed three lakes, four lakes. We patrolled all of the water control structures and the dam structures themselves and everything that went along with that. Plus, we also assisted the some of the park rangers because there were a lot of state parks in sure. association with the water project. And I did that for 4 years. And then I was I had to compete for my job all over again. I was hired without a test. I was hired without a formal oral. I was here, sign this and go to work.
This is amazing.
You got to go up to Sacramento to this particular store, get your uniforms, come back and we'll put you in the field. So it took me 2 days to get my uniforms. I got them squared away. I got back. And I went on for a week training with two other guys. And then I went into the field by myself.
No post certification.
Nothing. Zero. I qualified on the range. I don't know if you guys know what Camp Perry qualification is.
Oh, yeah. I do.
So for those
are you familiar?
No, I've never heard of that term.
For those who don't, it's... You're using a revolver, but you're firing it single action, and you have to cock the pistol each time you shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of wondering if they actually knew we had double action pistols.
Right. So, they're still thinking this is a Colt single action army.
Yeah. And so
why isn't he fanning it really fast?
I qualified, and I qualified with a shotgun. But then again, I was a country kid, so I was really good with a shotgun. So they put me out in the field by myself with a revolver, 18 rounds of ammunition, and no shotgun. So I started that. I did that for about 6 or 8 months, and I had to compete with other people that wanted that job that were coming out of the military. I did. I managed to secure that job. And then I worked that job for 4 years or almost 4 years, and then promoted to police officer and went to Los Angeles where I was going to be trained. But I worked the streets of Los Angeles with zero training until the academy show when I was supposed to go to the academy. So I went to the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Academy, class 189 on the hill of Biscaloo Center for 16 weeks.
And how long had you been on the job?
4 years.
Right. That's my favorite part.
4 years. But that was quite common in those days. I mean, and where I live right now, it's still kind of common.
Well, so it's interesting that you say that because I'm not completely unfamiliar with this concept. I worked with a police officer who started his career in Ohio, and he got hired onto a small town department and did like 9 months on patrol with a training officer before he ever went close to an academy. And it was nowhere near the kind of academy we think of nowadays. It was, you know, very abbreviated, you know, almost part-time book learning, and the rest, they just figured the department would show you.
Well, so my department didn't show me dick.
Right.
Imagine being out there by yourself in the middle of nowhere and carrying the weapon of an individual who was one of three people on the state police that were actually killed in line of duty. And he drowned in the aqueduct that we were patrolling. And
here's his gun.
They issued me his gun. And I said, I'm not carrying this. I'm not carrying this gun. It came out of the aqueduct. I'm not carrying it. You send this sucker back up to Sacramento and tear it all apart and make sure it's not rusted on the inside. I'm not carrying it. And they said, well, you don't have to carry it. I said, good. Can I carry my own? They said, yeah. So I had a, I had a Colt Trooper that was probably about 30 years old at the time. It was in better condition than the Smith & Wesson they issued me. So I carried my own Colt Trooper for quite some time after that. And once I competed and got the job, then I had to recompete to get a police officer's job with the state police in Los Angeles. So I did that. And then they had a hiring freeze. So that took a while. Then the hiring freeze went away. And I showed up in Los Angeles in 1978 and then went to the LA County Sheriff's Office or Sheriff's Department Academy in 1978 and graduated in the top 10% of the class. And then I was assigned to Los Angeles as a California State Police officer, fully trained, ready to rock and roll.
Yeah.
And working for an agency that didn't want me to rock and roll. And
right. Anything but for them.
Yeah. Well, you have to understand that state police, the functions of the state police were a lot different than most other police agencies. We were responsible for providing police services to state facilities and property.
Right.
That we were contracted for.
Then what happened after that? Because there's no more state police.
Well, I was on 20 years and 3 months. And in 1995, 21 years, 3 months, I was on. And then in 1995, because of the political climate at the time and that the state was broke, they decided that they were going to cut back the state police from a 24/7 full service police agency to an 8 hour a day guard service, basically. Right. And that didn't
only
sit
during
well,
business so hours.
We lost 60% of the people on the state police department, and they left and went to other departments, which was a kind of a trademark of the state police. We hired and trained more people for more departments than you can imagine. And I have guys that I trained personally that went to work. 8 guys I trained personally all of them went to other agencies.
Yeah.
And, you know, so
we called those starter agencies.
Yeah.
A lot of guys went there, proved that they could do the job, made themselves a proven commodity, went to a department they wanted to work at and bailed after a couple of years.
Well, that was my thought that I would stay with the state police, get trained and then go someplace else. But in the meantime, I gotten a back injury. So I wasn't really agencies weren't looking to hire people and buy a back injury at the same time.
Wanna,
so
yeah.
I was there with the state police for 21 years, 3 months. And then because the agency was going to more than likely be eliminated, association decided to talk to the Highway Patrol. And the Highway Patrol wanted our agency anyway. They wanted all of our functions and all of our authority because we did have quite a bit of authority. We protected the governor and other political dignitaries. We investigated all threats to political dignitaries and judges and stuff like that. So I mean, we had a really interesting job. And so the Highway Patrol wanted it. So we merged in 1995, July 1st, 1995. And I went from being a state police sergeant to a California Highway Patrol sergeant. And I worked in Altadena and then transferred to after being retrained. And then I went to from Altadena to Antelope Valley office in Lancaster, where I was living. So, and then good old Chuck came to live with me. And I was on the Highway Patrol at the time. And so we had an interesting life, me and Chuck, while we were both living in Lancaster and I was working on the Highway Patrol. And that's where I retired from. That occurred in 95. And I went to Antelope Valley in 97. And I retired in 2006 with 32 years of total state service.
Congratulations. I would argue you were there for the moment the Highway Patrol grew up and became a law enforcement agency.
Well, they would argue with you about that.
I'm sure they would.
There was there was quite a lot of difference between our two agencies and some sort of animosity. And so we had to fight through all that, but I managed to do it because I didn't really care about all that. I was just wanting to do the job. And I quite enjoyed working on the Highway Patrol. It was, for me, it was the best place that I could have ended up. And working out in the desert was fun for me. And being a supervisor and being out there and working with a lot of senior officers and, you know, working in that portion of the desert, that was a pretty active area. We arrested a lot of people and we investigated a lot of crashes. We had the second highest fatal rate in the state. So we were quite busy being a sleepy little office.
Right. And that there's some, you know, some of the finest police officers ever to grace California have been spawned by the California Highway Patrol. Gordon Graham comes to mind, you know. And
I know Gordon well.
Yeah, Gordon's I was in a training class of all places, sitting at the back of the class. I'd 3 days into this training class. On the fourth day, Gordon Graham shows up to speak. And for those of you who don't know, Gordon Graham is a nationally recognized law enforcement mind who is part of the genius of Lexapol, the policy and procedures think tank, if you will. So Gordon Graham used to be with the Highway Patrol, and that's kind of how he got into all that. And so here I am sitting in this little class, been there for 3 days. On the fourth day, Gordon Graham gets up. We all know who he is. We all know what he's done. And the guy leading the class goes, "Hey, Gordon, see this kid over here?" And Gordon says, "Yeah." And he goes, "It's Rob Gandy's kid." I'm like, "Oh, son of a, are you kidding me?" Like, so to know that you know him, I know it means that you're in good company, because Gordon's one of the finest guys to ever come out of that whole organization. So I think that working with the Highway Patrol and working with some of the guys, they really are out there trying to do great stuff. And the stuff you deal with on the freeway, I don't even want to go on the freeway. That's just it. I don't want to work the freeway.
Well, working the freeway, I almost got smoked on the freeway while I was in Altadena. Or actually, I was. It's the Altadena office. We were right at the, it's like the four level area of the freeway where three freeways come together: the 118 and the Interstate 5 and the 210.
Oh, right, yeah.
It looks like a big pile of spaghetti,
like a knot. Yeah,
bridge structures. And we had a crash underneath there, and a car came off one of those levels, and we got there and guy's leg was sticking out the top of the car there. He had a moonroof. Well, his leg removed the moonroof, and his leg was sticking straight up out of the moonroof. He was still belting in the car, but
seatbelts work.
Yeah. They played hell getting him out of there, but we were closing down one lane to get him out, and the flares were running out, and my patrol car was parked there. And I took a couple of minutes to get some more flares out, and I had to raise the lid, the trunk lid, and to get my flares. And I did that, and it covered my lights. And while I was getting the flares out, their other flares died. So it's the middle of the night, it's graveyard shift. And here comes a car straight at me. And all I hear is their brakes when they finally see me. And I turn around, and it's to them, I must have looked like a deer in the headlights, because I couldn't move. All I could see is this car and full four wheels, lock brake skid coming at me. And I'm thinking, you know, that I'm going to disappear any second now. And the car stopped within maybe 8 to 10 feet from where I was standing, right at the back of my car. And I did have the presence of mind when I first heard the screeching and everything to bring the trunk lid down. So now they could see my lights, and they managed to stop without killing me. And it's an old couple in the car, and they were very apologetic. And I'm going, just go, just, just go. I just go. I pointed.
We have nothing to say to each other.
just go, please, just go.
And, right. And they that was left. Not a good moment for either of us.
I collected my thoughts and I had to go back to the office and change uniforms, but it was quite an eye opener. You know, people don't realize the danger that highway patrol officers are actually in, right, working the highways, and even worse, the deserts. When you're out in the desert, you're out on these sleepy little roads where nobody seems to be until two cars come together and everybody in the cars dies, you know, and
right,
we've had that several of those. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I got there in 97 and 98 and 99. I worked the last and the first fatal of the last fatal of 98 and the first fatal of 99. Both of them were families of four that died in the crash.
Ugh.
So,
Jesus.
And the first one was a family of four that went off of the Angeles Crest Highway on the day after Thanksgiving of 1998. And, they were headed back from Victorville and having dinner with their family. And they decided, well, let's show the kids the snow, because it was snowing up there. And they went up and over, and the kids, they had stopped to help some people with a flat tire. The kids were out playing in the snow and got all wet. So they'd taken all the clothes off the kids and turned the heater on in their truck that they were in. And away they went up and over the Angeles Crest. And, they didn't make it. They hit a patch of black ice and launched over a guardrail and went down. They hit two trees, and in midair, they hit these two trees. And the truck turned over, and the driver was ejected. Well, best we could figure is he was ejected either on the first bounce going down the hill, or he was ejected when they hit one of the trees. But it was an avalanche slide area that they have skinned off, no trees and everything, just so snow will slide off. And the truck bounced down 600 feet down the side of the mountain, came to rest, and the driver had been ejected, and the truck landed on top of him. And the passenger was the mother, and she survived the initial crash. We suspect she had a serious head injury, although we couldn't find anything of her except for her torso and part of both legs. She had been devoured by animal life. And the two kids, we don't know how they died, other than they were dead, and they were holding on to each other, and they were found frozen to death in the car. And I had to work that one, and we went up. I took two of my officers, and we went up onto the crest, and we had to walk in, because our four-wheel drive wouldn't make it all the way. We had to walk in. And so we did. And we were there when they recovered all these bodies, and we were there when they coroner packaged them up. So we helped the coroner package up these four bodies. I still see them every once in a while in my dreams.
Yeah, that would stay with you, especially the kids.
And then that was the last one of that year. Then January, on the same shift, on the afternoon shift, there was a car going southbound on the 14, and he was traveling a little too fast and hit a big patch. It had been raining like crazy. He hit a big patch of water and hydroplaned, spun out, went across the freeway. And this was in the days before there was an actual barrier across the 14. It was just open. Right. And he went, slid across there, and he got broadsided by a family of four who couldn't stop because he was in their lane. And the car that hit him was a Mazda, and they were the family of four in it, and they spun out and went over the side, which was probably about 30 feet down. and they rolled down, and everybody in the car, all the whole family, were killed. So that was an interesting first 2 years in Antelope Valley. We had the most fatals of any of the area offices in Southern Division, which is Los Angeles County. And
had you ever dealt with anything like that at state police? Or was
I dealt mostly not with crashes. I did deal with a couple of crashes when I worked with the aqueduct. We had a couple of cars go in the aqueduct, and we had I stopped to assist on several different highway patrol crashes, you know, that out in my area. And yeah, they were pretty gnarly, some of those. But I never had, you know, a whole family wiped out, and then back to back two families. One in December, one in January, two different years, you know, that was a commentary for our area. You know, it's a very dangerous area. Everybody thinks, well, the desert, nothing goes on out there. Bet me, you know, we've lost lots of families out there. We've lost, we lost a mom and a dad, in a Jeep that got head on out on the 138. And the only one that survived that was the guy that hit him and the 2-year-old son that was in the back seat of their car. And he broke both his femurs, but he survived it. And we've had lots of crashes like that. And they kind of stay with you. You know, we didn't get into a lot of the shootings, although we did have 17 in 1997. When I first got out to the Antelope Valley, there were 17 officer involved shootings, and our department was involved in 3 of them. So I got to work with the sheriff's department on some shooting and barricaded suspect incidents where we came in and we provided the traffic control and closed off certain areas and provided that sort of assistance. Sure. But, work in the desert is a very eye-opening experience. We've had guys that transferred in from the city that never worked and had been on the CHP, you know, for a number of years and had never worked a fatal crash. And then all of a sudden they come to work with us out in the desert, and within a couple of weeks they're working a fatal.
Yeah. I think anybody listening, it'd be interesting to find out, but I would be willing to hazard a guess, if you live in some of these areas where there's these long dark stretches of highway, the California desert, you know, going out to Vegas, going out to Victorville, going out to Barstow, going out to, you know, Mammoth, going out to all these places, long stretches of 2-lane blacktop, beautiful scenery, but man, the crashes when they happen are horrendous, and they just take people.
I personally responded to one. I thought it was an airplane crash. There was parts of cars and stuff everywhere. Two people dead, and 21-year-old girl was one of the at-fault driver. And we found her in the lane. She was crushed up pretty bad, and we found her arm on the shoulder. So, I mean, you get there and you see carnage everywhere, and you're trying to put it all back. And then your job is you have to bring in a special team that has to put all this back together again, so we can figure out who's at fault and how the crash occurred.
Yeah. And I don't think people truly realize how much working a bad crash is like working a bomb scene.
Oh yeah. Well, it's like working a mass casualty situation.
For sure.
You know? And I've had several incidents where I've had a fatal crash, and the next call that came out was a fatal crash on the same day in the same shift.
Right.
You know, we had a guy go into a road rage incident on the 138, and the individual that was creating the road rage tried to cut somebody else off, and he was driving well beyond his skill, and ended up crashing through about 15 feet of compressed about 15 feet of steel guardrail into about 3 feet, and went through a telephone pole and a street sign, and ended up upside down in the aqueduct. one of my officers was given a Medal of Valor for trying to rescue this guy in the aqueduct, and he couldn't even get under the water because of the current. So the guy was finally pulled out, one single fatal, but he was the at-fault party. He just couldn't keep his mind together and went out of control and killed himself. And then within an hour or 2 hours after that occurred on the next shift, we were called out again to another crash. It was a double fatal on a 14, it happened in one day. There were several incidents that happened like that, fatal after fatal, one the same day. Right. So you see what for me, the biggest part of my career, the most memorable part of my career was the Highway Patrol, and was for me working these kinds of incidents, these kinds of crashes, where you see the result of someone who's been drinking.
Right.
And, I could never understand why guys I work with would, even though they would see the same things I would see, would go and go out and have a couple of beers and then get behind the wheel. I couldn't do that. If I, my personal rule was, if I went out and I had anything to drink, my wife would drive.
Yeah.
I just wouldn't do it. And I still have visions in my head from time to time at night, or even during the day, when you'll see something that will spark a memory about one of these fatals, and you'll see the faces of the individuals. The drunks that caused the crashes, they don't seem to bother me as much as the victims. No.
Right.
Of the, the crashes, and what you had to do to assist the family of those victims, we had an incident that I didn't work personally, but it was a fatal involving a daughter of a local fireman, and he showed up. He was on scene. He was one of the firefighters that responded, and he recognized his daughter's car, and he wanted to get down there. And it was a battle between the Highway Patrol guys and the fire department trying to keep him out of there, because right. She was dead and the top of her head was missing. And we didn't want him to see that. Fuck. We didn't want that to be his last visual of his daughter. We right. had incidents out here in the valley where we've had, I was kind of keeping score of which high school was going to lose a kid this year in a crash. And,
well, you wouldn't let me buy a fast car because you saw a kid from one of the local schools out here crash his Mustang and burn to death.
Yeah. Well, so I bought you an old plumbing truck.
It was a piece of shit,
but it worked. He was driving.
He's alive. He
got back and forth to school. And I personally bought him a vehicle that was going to burn a lot of gas, and he'd have to pay for the gas. So he wouldn't be going far and wouldn't be going fast.
I just wanted a Honda Civic. That's all I wanted.
And I told him, if you get stopped and you get arrested for DUI, or you get arrested for something stupid, and
I don't know you.
and you, if they call me, I'm going to tell them to keep you, because I've told you. And luckily for me, he didn't get arrested. He didn't get caught doing any of the stupid things that kids do. But, I saw the results. And I always tell people, particularly kids that don't understand, that potentially the most dangerous thing most people will ever do in their life is get behind the wheel of a car.
Yep.
Because most people aren't going to go out mountain climbing. They're not going to jump out of airplanes. They're not going to do any of that stuff. They're just going to go to work hard and party hard on the weekends, and then get behind the wheel of a car.
Right. And it's not you. It's the other person. It's it's always the other person. So
it's always.
Chuck, I want to try something fun. I wanted to spend, because your dad just started talking about what you were like as a teenager. And I know we joked about it, but let's turn the tables a little bit. So cop to cop. Is there anything you've ever wanted to ask your dad? Because he's on the show now, he's not your dad. You can ask him about police work. What is it that you've always wanted to get out of your dad? Now's your chance. He's sitting right there. He's on the spot. He's on the show. He has to tell the truth. The law.
He has to tell the truth. Well, one is related to police work. He left out something when he was giving his resume. He was a sergeant, and then a sergeant on the state police, and a sergeant on the CHP. But there was a rank in between there that was higher than both of those.
You talk about lieutenant?
Yeah. What happened and why were you a lieutenant and then it became a sergeant again? I've always wanted to know. I've never gotten a straight answer in 32 years.
You want me to be diplomatic, or do you want me to? Because it's difficult to tell that without being very angry.
That's your call, Chuck.
There's
tell the truth.
Guys I worked with on the state police and from other departments that I worked around, they always said, you're not a cop until you've been in this shit. And by that, I mean that you've had more than one investigation on you.
Yeah, I was always told if you didn't get at least one IA in your career, you weren't doing your job.
It was, well, on our department, on the state police, we called it riding the tiger. And if you can successfully ride the tiger, or if you have ridden the tiger, then you must have been doing your job the way you were supposed to do it.
Cop's cop.
Because when I started in 74, and all the way up until Rodney King.
Yeah.
All the way up until that point, and that was what, in the 90s? I was old school cop. And if you got out of line, you know, certain things would happen to you. And I was hard-nosed at the time, but not to the point of really hurting anybody. But I had, on the state police, I had worked my way from state security officer to state police lieutenant. And I was actually on a captain's list when the transition occurred. But there was the political climate in the area that I worked was kind of strange. When I was a lieutenant, I was told there was a couple of incidents that occurred where I put some people in their place and they didn't like it. And it was due to the political climate at the time. And it's kind of interesting how things tend to repeat themselves throughout history, you know.
Right, yeah.
In the 60s and 70s, people hated cops. Right. You would go to a bar at night and never tell anybody you were a cop. You'd make up a story, a lie, tell you were a trash, you know, that you collected trash for a living. And which was true, but you didn't tell them what kind of trash. But
no, that's the way I was raised.
And so I was pretty much a straight shooter, but I was an old school old soul, and and I pissed off some people at the top. And I was actually ordered by when I was lieutenant, I had five offices that I supervised and a command office. And I was also the one person who signed all the permits for people to use state property. And lots of people didn't get to use state property. I had quite a lot of authority. I was third in command in the South State. And only a lieutenant. And one of my supervisors was being transferred against his will, which was against policy. And so he didn't want to be transferred, so he sued. And the deputy chief at the time ordered me not to, I was subpoenaed to go and testify for my officer, for my sergeant that was working for me. And I got a call from the deputy chief and he says, I heard you got that subpoena to go. And I said, yeah, well, I'm telling you, I don't want you to go. I said, well, you can't tell me that. It's a subpoena. It's issued by a judge. You know, you don't respond to a subpoena. You go to jail.
Right.
I'm not going to jail. And he and I argued the point a little bit. And finally, I just said, yeah, okay, fine. I called the sergeant and I said, hey, this is just tell your attorney this just transpired, but I still will be there. And I showed up and he was there. And we told the judge, and the judge, there was a big argument in court. And the judge had to stop the proceeding and says, okay, we're not going to hear this today. We're going to hear this next week on this day at this time. Everybody be here, and nobody is not going to be here. Everybody's going to be here. Got that? And so everybody went, yeah. And the deputy chief went, okay. So I testified against him in court. So that was kind of like the first straw. And there was a couple more things. And when the transition was going to occur, prior to our transition to the highway patrol, the state was dead broke. So they were going to reduce us in size. And they came down and they said to everybody, the chief said to everybody in every area office he visited, that they were going to start laying people off. And when you start that layoff stuff, people get scared.
Yep.
And so they start looking for other homes that are more secure. And I said to the chief point blank, I told him, I said, listen, how many people do we have to lose in order to not lay off? And he says, 10% of our personnel have to find other homes, or we'll start laying off. And I said, so if 10% leave, are you going to encourage everybody else to stay? And he wouldn't answer the question. I asked him several times. He wouldn't answer the question. And so when 60% of the total personnel left, went to other state agencies, went to other, I thought it interesting that they could go to other state agencies that I thought we were all having a budgetary problem,
but right.
Apparently not. So, they went to other state agencies. They went to city agencies. They went a lot of places. I even tried to go, but I couldn't. So I was stuck. And the deputy chief came to pay me a little visit. And he said, have you been out recruiting? And I said, recruiting? So we lost 60% of the people in our agency because you people up there. And he was a walk-on. He'd never been in charge of a large police agency, and he had never been a uniformed cop. So he didn't know about uniformed police work and what it entailed. So he said, well, you got to go out and recruit people to, I said, we shouldn't have to recruit. We never should have lost these people to start with. So I don't understand why I need to go out and recruit. He says, well, you know what, Lieutenant, you're not telling me anything I want to hear. And I said, well, I guess, Chief, you're just not going to hear what you want to hear today. And then shortly thereafter, there was another incident that occurred in our office, and I used some off-color language, and they brought me up on charges. And they took me to task. And in the meantime, the commander who was in place at the time, he left. He was transferred out. The other people that were there, they had all gone. And they brought in a new commander. And on April 1st, which was my anniversary, he brought me into the office and said, this is my first official task as your commander. And he says, and I don't like it. And I said, well, what is it? And he says, you're being demoted. I said, oh. He says, I can understand if you're angry about this. And I said, he told me what it was for, and I expected some sort of disciplinary action, but I didn't expect to get demoted. So he said, you can go home if you want. I didn't want to go home. And he says, it's not going to take place for another 10 days. So I got to thinking, and I said, you know what? I'm not working another minute. I went into my office. I filled out 6 on-duty related injury reports, and I'd already had an on-duty related injury, but I'd been injured a couple of months prior to this, but I didn't really, even though I reported it, I didn't really do anything about it, but I thought this is a good time to do something about it. So I did. I filed all this action and I walked out and I dropped that stuff on the new commander's desk. And I say, I hate to do this to you, but there it is. I'm not working another day here, and I will never come back to this agency. I will never wear a set of stripes again in this agency. So I walked out, and 19 months later, actually it wasn't even 19 months later, but less than a year later, the transition occurred, and we were all highway patrolmen at that time. But I had I'd been home quite a while, being treated for back injury and a whole bunch of other stuff, and I grew my hair out long and had a ponytail and a beard and all kinds of stuff. And then we had to go take pictures for the highway patrol new ID card. Oh boy, this was going to be fun. So I shaved my beard, but I left my hair, pulled it back, and had my I still have that ID card. It was kind of the chief, Deputy Chief Ed Gomez at the time, when he was handing out the ID cards, he goes, "Here's your ID card. This is a nice picture. Do you like it?" I said, "Yeah, I do." I said, "But you got to understand, Chief, I've been out on injury, so I haven't cut my hair." And he goes, "Oh, never mind." So that's why I'm not, I didn't come to Highway Patrol as a lieutenant. I came over as a sergeant. I stayed a sergeant. I had an opportunity to promote to a lieutenant after that, but I decided not to. And when I was asked,
I don't blame you.
When I was asked, I told the captain that I was working for, who's now a very, very good friend of mine, and Chuck's. He asked me, why didn't you take the test for lieutenant? I said, they didn't give me enough time to study for it. And I said, I got to thinking about it, and I said, I don't want to be a lieutenant. He goes, why? And I said, because I don't want to sell my integrity for a set of bars. And I knew that if I went to a larger office, I'd have to do that. And I wasn't going to do that. I wasn't going to be somebody's patsy for a set of bars.
I can absolutely respect that.
I'll stay a sergeant and I'll retire as a sergeant. It's the two best positions on the highway patrol are sergeant and captain. And nobody screws with you as a sergeant. Nobody screws with you as a captain. So
it's perfect.
Yeah. So that's what I did.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, Robert. And Chuck, there's your answer.
I guess so.
I have a feeling that when the microphone's off, you can get the other, like the details on the colorful language.
Yeah. So at the end of every episode, we offer the guest someone to dedicate the episode to. So speaking with you prior, we know that you have someone to dedicate it to. So this is a good time to do that.
Well, he's a California Highway Patrol officer. I met him. His name is Matt Gibbs. We met in the Antelope Valley. His wife, Cassandra, was also a highway patrol officer and also assigned to the Antelope Valley. And I knew them the entire time I was there, when I was there in the Antelope Valley for 10 years. And I retired in 06. They both retired just a few years ago. But Matt went to work after retired from the highway patrol. He went to work for, I think it was the San Diego County Sheriff's Office, and he was working for the court system, and he contracted COVID. And I don't think Matt had reached the age of 60, because he retired at 50. So I think he's still in his 50s, and he contracted COVID, and he passed away with COVID. And I've lost quite a few friends and people that I worked with over the past 2 or 3 years due to natural causes and things. You know, they're mostly retired. Matt was a good guy. He was a He's a good friend. And it's the first name that popped into my head when you said I could dedicate it to somebody. So,
well, Officer Matt Gibbs, rest easy, brother. We got it from here. Chuck, thanks for bringing your dad on, man. I'm sure we have only scratched the surface of the stories.
He's got a lot more. He's on during some riots, and he was an instructor for PR24. He's utilized that thing a bunch of times. There's some more stories there that he talks about. Yeah,
we'll definitely have to get this played wishbone again with a suspect.
No, but I've made him do the chicken.
Right. I do want to say one thing though. If people are looking to come on to the show and come on to the podcast, go to booking.warstories@gmail.com and email me there, and we can get you onto the show. If you're a first responder, military vet, or in the military, nurse, or what have you, and you have a good story, want to come on and talk, email me there. We'll talk about it, and we can get you onto the show. Also, we do have, we're waiting on our patches to arrive, and then we're going to be doing a massive drop. We should have some more stickers and everything that are coming soon. So we'll have probably three sets of stickers. I'm trying to get a fourth one. We are trying to get a fourth one, to release to you guys, to give you guys some more artwork and more ways to support the podcast. And as always, you can reach out to us on Facebook, on Instagram, and just War Stories Official. Go there, reach out to us there if you can't remember the email. But again, it's booking.warstories@gmail.com to book a slot on the podcast.
Yes. And I had a couple of emails we were going to read, but we were short on time this week. So I wanted to mention to Troy and Danny and some of the other emailers. We're going to try and get to your emails next week. But until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.